This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're not taking calls today because the show's pre-recorded. Punk rock erupted onto the American music stage in the late 1970s with its stripped-down sound, aggressive tones, and manic beats. Over the next decade, punk's music and attitudes demonstrated a calculated rejection of the perceived excesses and insincerity of music and media of the disco 70s. Certainly, punk meant different things to different people, but there was a definite theme to much of the music that had a political message. That's what David Insminger writes in his book, The Politics of Punk, Protest and Revolt from the Streets. And he says this is a good example of it, this 1988 song, You Are the Government by Bad Religion.
So the song is You Are, otherwise known as You Are the Government by Bad Religion, who's been playing off and on since the early 1980s and continues to tour. And I think the song kind of really captures the tenor of the time, especially coming off this election cycle. And the lyrics are things like, as the people bend, the moral fabric dies, and thus the country can't pretend to ignore its people's cries. You are the government. You are jurisprudence. You are volition. And so I think what it's underscoring and highlighting is the power of the people to change the course of government. And although Bad Religion may not agree with where that government's going today, I think it definitely believes in the power of people to shape it and their will to be not just the voice of democracy, but to actively pursue shaping their own destinies and their sort of political future.
Well, what about the idea that the people are responsible for the government? You know, we have a government doing things and they're doing it in our name.
Yeah, I mean, it's complicated. And so who does this current government going to represent? And probably not the members of Bad Religion, who probably find themselves more along the left liberal spectrum and perspective. So this is sort of the end of the Reagan era and the beginning of the Bush era.
But it still resonates today.
Sure. I mean, I think that what's interesting about all the songs that I picked out, I could have picked out a million different punk rock songs that address all types of different areas in the political sphere, but I picked ones that really capture what's happening right now and in the moment. And so I think this one, again, it's sort of about what happens to the moral fabric of a people, especially right now when we have somebody elected whose moral fabric has been questioned consistently over the last year and year and a half. And so even people who voted for him, who may be evangelicals and stuff like that, will have to deal with the fact that he may be making decisions that goes against some of their core values and definitely against many of the core values of those in the punk community. Not everyone in the punk community, but definitely those in the left liberal perspective.
So you're seeing a resurgence in the punk community?
Yeah. I mean, right now we say that, you know, this is about the best thing that could have happened for the punk community. Think about it. For the last 8 years, we've had this moderate, liberal, centralist and what sort of technocrat and things like that. And so it's kind of hard to be in opposition to that in a very outspoken way. I mean, there were still obviously things that we in the community fought for and against. But now, you know, anything goes, basically. And again, not everybody on the punk rock represents that. There are members of popular bands who vote Republican and are right-wing and things like that.
Right, and we'll get into all that, but there's a political spectrum in punk rock as well.
Even within single bands, even within a single band, you may find that.
So the politics of punk, protest and revolt from the streets, and you're looking at the early days of punk rock, and I thought that punk rock was actually a rebellion against commercialism and popular culture.
Sure. Yeah, of course it is. But it took place in, you know, in the mid-70s, and there were sort of proto-punk elements before that that sort of grew out of the hippie era and the counterculture era. And then, you know, 1975, you know, you had the Ramones in places like New York and Patti Smith. And then over in England, you had the Sex Pistols, the Buzzcocks, and the Clash all sort of cohering together in 1976. And there was a political response to the times, and that certainly carried forward all the way until today. Like, for instance, I picked up the newspaper today, and they were talking about an article in Vice Magazine magazine about Muslim punks sort of applying post-colonial theory to their sort of dissenting voice against what they see happening in Washington with this election. And when you go to urban communities like Los Angeles, there's a big contingent of punks that are Hispanic, and so they're going to be dealing with issues like immigration rights and whatnot. In the trans community, you have a band like Against Me who has a trans singer, and so they're dealing with issues that are felt by the trans community, which is prejudice, rights at the workplace, where you can use bathrooms in some states. And so there's a million type of politics, and right now we see them all sort of percolating to the surface, not simply because of our president-to-be, but also because there's so much more participation and multiculturalism within punk itself.
I'm going to play a song that I thought sort of summed up punk rock, which was Whatever You've Got, I'm Against It, sort of a Marlon Brando Wild Ones thing. And this is the Ramones. We're speaking with David Insminger. He is the author of the book, The Politics of Punk. What do you think about that song?
So that definitely goes back to that cultural sphere of being sort of disenchanted, rebellious, the other, and questioning moral authority. I think that's on the 1978 Road to Ruin record, if I remember correctly, which is a fantastic record with Marky debuting on drums. What was interesting, as they grew into the 80s, they became quite a political force, and so they wrote political songs like Bonzo Goes to Bitburg, which was about Reagan going to Germany and laying a wreath on Nazi graves. And, you know, these are a bunch of Jewish kids from Queens. And, of course, I think people like to think that, oh, they're just rebelling against commercial music. No, they weren't. I mean, Joey the singer was very outspoken in his support of human rights. So he would go to places and say things like, we're the Ramones and we believe in human rights before they would begin their songs.
And they weren't going to play in Sun City.
Yeah, exactly. And then the drummer, Marky, you know, I think straight up said that he was a socialist at one point in an interview. Now, that's not shared by Johnny. Johnny, typically, we think of as a baseball-loving patriot and kind of a right-winger. So even within that band, you have these tensions and whatnot. And then the band did fight against sort of censorship in the late 80s and the efforts led by Tipper Gore to sort of put labels on music and, you know, when you would purchase them at stores. And so it's an interesting and fascinating story. And then when they put out Too Tough to Die, they had a song called Planet Earth 1988, which addressed all kinds of concerns, including sort of notions of environmentalism and Armageddon and militarism.
I'm going to play another quick Ramones song, which some people say is political and some say it's just satirical, and it's Teenage Lobotomy. Now, is it just satire of suburban life, or is this really a political statement? Or just in it being of itself, just being a Ramon is a political statement?
I'm a teenage lobotomy, meaning that I feel like I'm sort of other, I'm a misfit, I'm a geek, I'm sort of left out of the equation, I'm not flowing with the rest of America. And so they're sort of announcing this proudly. You know, we're pimple-faced skinny geeks who love pizza and hamburgers and have leather jackets and look like thugs, right? And so it's speaking to this whole group of people. You know, if you think about it, eventually coming millions when bands like Green Day and Nirvana break out, who feel like they're not fitting with the flow of America and the status quo and sort of mainstream monoculture. And so I think it is a hyperbole. I think it's sort of comical. I think it's farcical. I think it's ironic. And I think it is a political statement that's sort of universally felt. I mean, the Ramones are beloved people in places like Argentina.
It's funny how the Ramones have become this major pop icon. When they were alive and gigging, they were having trouble finding places to play and making money. I mean, they were not successful.
Yeah, I think they sold about 100,000 records per release, which is, you know, I guess you would say probably nothing compared to the major stars of today. But at the same time, that's about what Steve Earle sells to his core audience. So you got to kind of put it in perspective. But they made a huge cultural impact, right? They are known exactly like the Sex Pistols as sort of creating this rupture within American pop culture consciousness. And I think that speaks much louder than record sales.
But what about today of them being used in ads for Target, or I can even when I'm walking through the grocery store playing through the music?
Well, sure. But you got to remember bands like Jefferson Airplane were selling jeans and things like this. So they were always been used for radio ditties and whatnot and jangles. And same thing goes for other bands as well in the punk spectrum. Iggy Pop, you know, he's featuring all kinds of commercials these days. Johnny Rotten, I think, did a butter commercial and whatnot. I don't think it takes away from or distracts us from sort of the core message of the music. It's just that at some point people got to pay the bills, and this is one way to do it.
Politics of Punk on The Source. We're taking a break. We'll be right back. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We cannot take your calls today because this is a pre-recorded program. We're talking about the politics of punk, protest, and revolt from the streets with David Insminger. So, David, it was a revolt from the streets, but which streets in particular?
Well, when it first started, I think we really saw it gestating in places like London and in Manchester. You know, we had the Buzzcocks up there, and then later on Joy Division. Definitely within New York, definitely within San Francisco, where you had great bands like Crime, and down in Los Angeles, you had a million bands, but great bands like X and whatnot. But even in San Antonio, and you had the Vamps in San Antonio, who opened up for the Sex Pistols when they played Randy's Rodeo in 1978 on that tour, which was an infamous tour. You had bands in Austin who were great. Jerry's Kids right out of there. STB, you had the Big Boys, you had the Dicks. And then in Houston, we had bands like My Dolls and Really Red and others too.
And this is the Austin punk band Big Boys with a 1982 recording of Fun, Fun, Fun. We'll be right back.
And so, but I also don't want to think it was just an urban phenomenon, because very quickly it sort of spread out through suburbia. So when we talk about hardcore taking root in 1979 and 1980, that's pretty much the result of that sort of punk rock consciousness creeping out to the suburbs, and then those kids forming their own bands and then reacting to what they maybe thought was punks. You know, maybe it was too slow, or maybe it was too traditional rock, or maybe it was too boring. And so those kids sort of sped it up, and that's that hardcore sound is a little more brash. It's a little more in your face. It's a little more stripped down musically. But that took place through even small towns like my own in Rockford, Illinois, which is out in the farmlands.
But still, it seemed like an emotional outburst and not so much a political philosophy that was being, you know, unraveled or being, you know, laid out.
There's a million different approaches to it. I don't think that really holds true, because very quickly we saw people sort of looking at punk rock and seeing its sort of political value and worth. That doesn't mean everyone's going to agree with me. Writers like Dave Lang kind of questioned it. I once went to school with somebody who was actually in Italy at the time, and the move to England right during 1976, and he thought of himself as a very much a sort of partisan political kind of activist, and he sort of laughed off the punks. But I think in reality that certain things happened, like Rock Against Racism, which brought forces together. So you had people like the SWP, which is a Socialist Workers' Party, and you had a rising tide of sort of neo-fascism and what they call the National Front. And then punk bands began to respond by saying, hey, why don't we do concerts to sort of protest that growing right wing and all those sentiments? And so you would have these gatherings of like 70,000 people in places in England for these Rock Against Racism shows. And there's a very famous one with The Clash playing it, and then the lead singer Jimmy Percy of Sam 69 getting up, and they're singing White Riot together. And that's very much a political thing. And that happened just, you know, maybe a year or two after punk really broke and became a major thing in the United Kingdom, but also in the U.S.
Okay, so let's play that. Okay, let's play White Riot by The Clash.
Right.
It seemed like, though, that there was a play by the right wing, or even by the KKK and fascist groups. They thought that punk rock was something that they could take hold of.
Sure. Yeah, very much so. And in fact, they would bus people to gigs and things like that. And when you read about sort of especially the Oi and working class bands like Angelic Upstarts and Sham 69, there was this division in their fans. So they would attract people who were rather sort of right-wing from the skinhead element, as well with the Redskins, who were sort of the more political and labor-oriented skins as well. And those were sort of a volatile mix. But what's interesting with The Clash, they sort of drew from those working-class contingents as well. But Joe and Mick and the guys in the band always expressed a love for multiculturalism, always expressed sort of political dissent, always expressed a sense of fighting back against unfairness and injustice in the world. Even when they were covering songs like Armageddon Times, you know, they're worried about hunger and malnutrition and injustice in the world. And so they were able to pull in. This is what is told to me once you read it through the newspaper reports and once you read through some of the academics on it, is that they were able to take these kids who would have been vulnerable to the National Front and pull them away by creating a music that spoke directly to them and came from the streets, but yet expressed a kind of tolerance that these kids needed to hear so they wouldn't be so vulnerable to the right-wing elements.
Can't talk about The Clash without playing London Calling, so yeah. Let's do that.
Beatlemania is putting the dust. London calling, see we ain't got no swing except for the rain and the crunch of things. The ice age is coming, the sun's zooming in. Meltdown expected, the wheat is within. Engines stop running, but I have no fear, 'cause London is drowning.
We're talking about the politics of punk rock. It was liberal and loud. History professor David Insminger is the author of the book Politics of Punk, Protest and Revolt from the Streets. He also plays in a punk band himself, and he says the music and politics are making a comeback. More source and more punk when we come back from this NPR newscast.
It might have been Camelot for Jack and Jacqueline, but on the Che Guevara highway, filling up with gasoline. Fidel Castro's brother spies a rich lady who's crying over luxury's disappointment, so he walks over and he's trying to sympathize with her. But he thinks that he should warn her that the third world is just around the corner.
That's Billy Bragg, and it's his theme song, he says. It's Waiting for the Great Leap Forward. And we're speaking with the author of the book, The Politics of Punk, Protest and Revolt from the Streets. This is a pre-recorded show for The Source, and we can't take your calls today. And the author we're speaking with is David A. Insminger. And David, talk about Billy Bragg. Where does he fit in this?
Well, Billy comes directly out of the sort of punk rock phenomena of the late 70s, was a huge fan of The Clash. Joined the military service, got out of it, and then started playing, you know, picked up a guitar and playing his own version of sort of stripped down punk rock with sort of a melodic edge and sort of romantic element to it as well, like the Milkman of Human Kindness and songs like that. And then he goes on tour with bands like the Smiths and whatnot and sort of opens up his audience. He's definitely within that socialist tradition. He, and there, not just him, but you would have Paul Weller of the Jam and other bands like that would do these things called the Red Wedge Tours. I believe Billy was also on the tour that went to Eastern Germany in the mid-80s. And so they were trying to have this conversation with the other socialist parties within Europe and Eastern Europe, bring that sort of consciousness within pop music, but not in a very doctrinaire way or too ideological that would be off-putting to a lot of people. And so it was interesting that when he would tour America, he would play sort of like a lot of college campuses, and I remember seeing videos of it in the late 80s. And so he would bring in this sort of this contingent of young people who may not otherwise be involved with politics. And what he would do is he would spend time between the songs kind of bantering with them and asking them questions about U.S. policies towards things like Cuba, Central America, and places like El Salvador, Nicaragua. And then, of course, in some of his songs, those are very explicit. He's concerned with the conflict in Angola. He did not allow his records to be sold in South Africa. And so, you know, one person could sort of centralize all these different universal sort of punk concerns that fall within the political sphere, but he was able to bring them to college audiences who might not otherwise have listened to somebody who was, say, to just a political pamphleteer or somebody who's on a soapbox or somebody who's trying to protest outside a building holding placards up. And so I think that sort of initiated these conversations that probably would not have happened any other way.
And cut out the middle man. Right, click forward. A perfect world, we're all singing tune, but this is reality, skip some run. Right, click forward. So join the
But it seemed like the media was very interested in trying to portray punk rock music as just, they were in favor of anarchy, particularly anarchy in the UK, like the Sex Pistols wanted.
I think that's why punks always distrusted the major media. In fact, the campaign that sort of Jello Biafra kicked off was, you know, become the media. Right. And now what's interesting about that, that's what the right wing is saying. And that's what the alt-right exactly has done by setting up these websites and these news shows and whatnot and these Internet spaces for their alt-right, because they didn't see their voice being reflected. And that happened for years. And so we had what we call the Underground Fanzine Network that got started back in the late 70s with things like Sniffing Glue out of England. Moved forward in America with Punk Magazine out of New York, but then really took root in things like Flipside out of Los Angeles and Maximum Rock and Roll out of Berkeley. And what those did is they allowed punks to have their own media, their own network, their own way of getting their message out. And when you read those, and they're very much a reaction to what was happening in the major press, we always thought that we were misrepresented by the major press. You know, the major press would come into our concerts and they would see slam dancing and they saw that was chaos. But we saw it as kind of a choreography, a sort of, you know, this is before the big mosh pits and whatnot. So 81, 82, you would see these kids dancing around, but there is a sense of togetherness. There's a sense of community. There's a sense of bonding that was happening.
It was interactive. Just made it,
yeah, it was interactive and it was participatory. And it didn't matter if you're rich or poor or black or white or what part of the neighborhood you came from. You would all sort of join in this beehive of activity. But to the outsiders, they saw it as threatening and gross and inappropriate and malicious. But it wasn't like that at all.
So Billy Bragg still very active and and making music. Henry Rollins from Black Flag, similar, he became a standout individual coming from the punk scene. Let's play a Black Flag. This is Rise Above. Okay, Rise Above, this is political.
He goes, in the song they talk, I was born with a chance and I'm going to have my chance. No, Sir Rollins comes out of the Washington, D.C. scene. He had a band called SOA. He was friends with people in the Teen Idols and Minor Threat and whatnot. So they were close to these halls of power. You know, they were close to, you know the Capitol. So he was formulated within this sort of punk rock hardcore sphere. And then so when he goes out to L.A. and starts singing with Black Flag, he sort of fits into that rebellion that was happening. And one thing was interesting about Black Flag is that although they don't express the kind of politics that Billy Bragg does, they were dealing with their own kind of police harassment. So they had headquarters, it was called SST, and it was being monitored by the local police. They would try to do shows. They were continuously banned or shut down or sort of suppressed by the police. And that was happening throughout California. And so what we know now is that the police were actively keeping files on young hardcore kids. They might take their photos, take down their name. They would go to the shows. They would often shut them down quite forcibly. They make, you know, sometimes they would have a gauntlet, which kids would sort of try to escape out of the club, and they would be beaten by the police and handcuffed and taken away. And so there was sort of this systematic repression of the youth. And I think Black Flag, among many others, sort of was responding to that. So the music became that much more volatile, that much more vociferous, that much more powerful. And definitely that song in particular, I think, speaks to that, which is, you know, we're all given a chance and we need to take that chance. We need to have a sense of volition. We need to have a sense of opportunity, and we'd have a sense to live out our own dreams, even if you think those dreams are inappropriate.
Let's listen to another song. This is Class War by the Dills.
Yeah.
Why is Class War by the Dills worthy of examination?
I think we're in the middle of one. If you think about what happened this last election cycle, the majority of America who is in the rural areas, who feel like they've been left out of economic opportunities, who feel demoralized, some of them jobless, not knowing where their communities are going, these people feel like there's a class war between them and the elites in Chicago, the elites in Los Angeles, the elites in Washington, D.C., in New York City, that 1%. But I think that's what you're seeing. And in the song, this is, I think, 1978. And then, I want a war between the rich and the poor. I want to know what I'm fighting for. It's a class war. The left was always, coming from that socialist perspective, it's us versus them. It's the working class versus the rich, the bosses versus the workers and whatnot. And now it's sort of slightly changed because we're hearing this from communities all across America who might have been reluctant to say the word class war 20 years ago or 10 years ago. But now I think they're very much feeling it, and they're not afraid to talk about this conflict that even within our country, we seem to have two different societies.
You see a lot of these bands adopting names and slogans and icons of political activism, like a Red mm-hmm. Brigade and the Gang of Four. But did they really understand what they were emulating?
Well, I think it comes with a mixed bag. There's no doubt that there were direct actions taken by members of the punk community up in Canada. One of the members of the Subhumans was part of a militant group who did a bombing campaign and went to prison for that. And so in some cases, they very much knew what they were emulating. They knew the Red Army faction. And then in some cases, they were just wearing the T-shirts and really didn't know what was sort of really behind it. So I think there was probably a little bit of both. So there's talk minus action equals zero. That's what Joey from DOA says. And so it's about what you do with yourself. It's not just what you say. It's not just about your rhetoric. It's also about your actions. But what I think what DOA said is, okay, we don't need to put that into sort of militancy. What we could do is we could put it sort of into education and to supporting causes. It's reaching out in the community and fighting for rights and justice and fairness.
Okay, we're going to take a break. Let's play the New York Dolls' Personality Crisis as we go to break. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio.
Yeah, I agree.
Do you want your world to look like? What do you want it to be? Do you know that the wall has two sides and nobody is free? Did your mama come from Mexico? Papa come from Palestine? Sneaking all through Syria, crossing all the borderlines. Let the other people in. Listen to your women. Stop killing black children.
No more fat pigs.
Burn pigs!
That is the song Make America Great Again by Pussy Riot, which is a band out of Russia, which had a run-in with Putin, and who appears to be now someone who is gained favor in the United States. So Pussy Riot was a reaction to the authority in Russia. And do you think we're going to see similar types of reactions to what we're seeing in the United States now? We're speaking with David Insminger, the author of The Politics of Punk, Protest, and Revolt from the Streets. David.
Right. So when you take a look at that band, they're going to a church, they're performing in mask, and they're playing a kind of music that's not accepted in the sacred space. But what you see, it's interesting in Russia, is this collusion between the moral authorities and sort of the governmental authorities. And so Pussy Riot sort of says, well, we weren't protesting against government policy. We were protesting against sort of this suffocating sort of a moral authority that was occurring. And it didn't really matter because they were put into prison anyway. And so I think that's one of these situations where we began to realize just how sort of deadly and serious Putin really is with dissent within his own ranks and with his own people. And it was interesting, 7 Seconds actually toured Russia not too long ago. And so I asked him, I said, was this a conflict for you? Would you want to go to a place and be seen as popular entertainers where when you know that they are sort of systematically cracking down on dissent? And Kevin Sekas, the singer, told me, well, we talked about it with the promoters there. And the promoter said, if you don't show up, then we don't have any support for the people who are the dissenters. And so we need kind of ambassadors. And so 7 Seconds goes there with their messages are sort of positive and uplifting and for justice and fairness, and their songs typically represent that. And so they spoke to those kids. And so in a way, I hope that they bolstered the efforts of those who are dissenting and those who are struggling for their own rights in that city.
Why is that the vehicle? Why not letters to the editor?
Or they could do other forms like hip hop and soul. I think because what's most interesting about punk rock is that it lowers the barriers to participation. You don't have to be an expert. You don't have to be overly technical. You don't have to be overly skilled. You can sort of learn 2 or 3 chords, create a song, record it at home. Next thing you know, you're broadcast on YouTube, right? And so that's what punk rock is about. It's about lowering those barriers to participation so people can actively stir up culture and explain their viewpoints.
So punk rock is a legitimate form of social criticism. This is The Press Corps by Anti-Flag.
This song, The Press Corps, is released actually in the 2000s by Anti-Flag, and at this point they had been signed to RCA Records, which is a major record label, but they were using some of the funds of that to do things like trying to demilitarize high schools, which means you're creating these zones where people can't go in and recruit for the armed services. And so it was interesting. You could say, well, they were selling out because they moved from an independent label to a major label, so so you lose all your credibility, but I don't think that's true at all, because they were taking that money and doing these very powerful, direct, and worthy things, at least for those in the left perspective. And that song is all, again, it's about questioning the press corps, and especially into the lead up to different types of wars.
So are you seeing a resurgence of punk rock? I mean, how would we be able to judge that this is happening now?
I just played a show a week ago. I don't sit in an armchair. I go out and walk the walk. And so just a week and a half ago, I played a benefit show for this person called John Anderson, who was in a band called Doomsday Massacre. He had major heart surgery recently and cannot afford all the bills. And so what the punk rock community does is it sort of tries to fill in the gap. And so it tries to come together as a form of community and provide, you know, this was a temporary respite, like over $1,000, but for help him manage his bills. And it was interesting. We play with the band Screech of Death, and the Screech of Death's drummer is Arthur Hayes. Arthur Hayes was in the band The Vamps. The Vamps were the band that opened up for the Sex Pistols at Randy's Rodeo in San Antonio. I'm still making music. You go to any, I would say, mid to large city in America, they may be at house parties, that may be, you know, they may not be at major venues, but somewhere in some neighborhood, there's going to be a punk rock band playing.
Green Day is probably one of the most successful bands out there that may have come out of the punk scene. And probably a lot of the music consumers today don't even realize that they were a hardcore, you know, a real punk band at that time. But they have been political the entire time.
So I would say less so at the beginning, but definitely the beginning in their mid period all the way to today. Now, one thing I want to prove this with is that they came out in the American Music Awards and they played their song. But in the middle of that, they began with the chorus, "No Trump, no KKK, no fascist USA." Now, anybody in the punk community actually knows where that comes from. That comes from a song written about 1981, 1982 called "Born to Die" by MDC, who is based out of Austin. And in that song, "Born to Die," they have that chorus, but it's slightly different. No war, no KKK, no fascist USA. So what happened is that when Trump started running, people repurposed that and added Trump to the beginning. Okay. And then Green Day, being huge fans of MDC and having played with them in places in Berkeley when they first started in the late 80s or early 90s, took that and brought it to the masses on the American Music Awards. So I don't think anybody necessarily in that audience that night maybe knew it, but those of us in the punk community know, oh my God, this is a reference to MDC, an Austin punk band, and this is about the sort of revolt, even within pop music today, against the election.
The thing about punk rock is supposed to be a rejection of corporate media and commercial music and such. And so do you think with technology today that can actually exist and you can create and distribute music and gain an audience without the big labels?
In some ways, I think the major labels are obsolete and even they sort of recognize it themselves, but yet they still take up a big chunk of what sells, right? So the question is, does it matter what sells or does it matter what is out there? And I think that's probably the conversation we need to have. And there's a number of people who survive off things like selling tickets for their concerts rather than selling records. And so they put their stuff out there in various ways. You know, most of it may be free on YouTube, where most young people get their music today, or on streaming services like Spotify, where they just get a fraction of the money that you would get off, selling a CD or selling a record at a typical store. But yeah, you can bypass all that quite easily. You can set up your own networks. For 30, 40 years now, we've had these DIY networks. That's what sort of the Ramones went out and did. That's what the Black Flag went out and did. They navigated the territories. They gathered the phone numbers. They figured out the clubs. They told you who to trust and who not to trust. And so these bands are sort of just that living version of it 30, 40 years down the line. But they've also had their own networks. They're communicating with ways that I could only have dreamt of, 20, 30 years ago, Snapchat, Instagram, the ways that they're documenting their music, the way that they're disseminating their music, things like Bandcamp and the way they're putting it out. It's global. So the other thing is that it used to take forever to get a package from here to Taiwan or here to Indonesia or here to Australia, several weeks to do so sometimes. Now they can do it in a fraction of a second. So that is sort of a game changer. So when I get on Facebook and I'm having conversations, I'll have somebody contact me from South America, and it's like in almost instant time. So I think that has changed. But what is also slightly worrisome about that is that everybody's participating, who's listening. And are we sort of caught in these echo chambers? And, people have studied this, especially with this last election in Facebook. And does it make us better? Does it make us worse? Because are we closed off from others? And so are we having these conversations with these sort of hyphenated, super specific focused communities who may not be listening to each other? And I think punk rock has taught us to be sort of better than that and different than that, that, we need to have a bigger umbrella. We don't have to agree with everybody all the time, but, if we can meet them there about 70%. And it's also, I think we need to think about, we need to have less discord and we need to have more discourse. And I think that's what I hope will happen in the future, that we can have conversations, that we can get past these hurdles, especially with identity politics, and begin to discuss, where do we agree on issues of justice and human rights and fairness and democracy and inclusion and participation.
We're going to go out with this song. This is The Descendants, Everything Sucks.